Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Umberto Eco is an accomplished medieval scholar and author who is best known for his best-selling novel, The Name of the Rose. Now comes his latest, The Prague Cemetery, already a best-selling novel in 40 other countries around the world. The story is based on monstrous and mysterious events of the 19th century, including the death of Ippolito Nievo, the forgery of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Dreyfus Affair, and more. In the world that Eco creates, conspiracies abound, and one man finds himself in the middle of it all. It is a pleasure to welcome Umberto Eco to The Book Show. I thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure.
Thank you to you. Thanks.
What brought you to this particular subject, looking at something that would have your novel denounced by the Vatican?
As a scholar, I have always been interested, and also as a professor, to problems of languages. I mean, not only verbal language, but all the languages. And one of the characteristics of human languages is the possibility of lying. Because when a dog barks, it tells the truth. There is somebody down there.
Right.
But a dog is unable to bark, you know, that there is somebody and somebody is not there. So a dog cannot lie. Human can lie. So it's an important feature of human mind and language. Starting the problem of telling the contrary of the truth, I met the problem of forgeries in general. And I have written a lot during my, in the last, 30, 40 years, about all the different kinds of forgery from a linguistic point of view. And by in studying the forgeries, obviously the most radical, the most important, the most tragic among the forgeries that have shaped our history is the Protocols of the Elders of Science. And I was mentioning them in my second novel, Foucault's Pendulum. I wrote several essays on the concoction of this forgery, because also I believe to have found two additional sources in the dime novels of the 19th century. And I was more and more interested in the protocols for two reasons. One is that they are a highly self-contradictory text. In fact, it was composed as the Frankenstein monster with parts of different human corpses. And you see it. You see that it has been a sort of collage of different sources. So nobody could take them seriously. But it was taken seriously. Now it's sold in every newsstand in the Arab countries, studying in their school. But even in the Western world, you can give me the yellow pages, I find you two or three bookstores in which you are so sure you can find the protocols. The other reason is that in 1921, the London Times proved that they were a forgery, very clearly finding its sources. From that point on, it was more and more believed and taken seriously. So we are facing monstrous phenomenon, and I was interested in telling the story of how a forger can step by step build up such an object. Obviously, the protocols were the effect of a collaboration of many hands, while in my novel, for narrative reasons, I had to invent a unique character, Simonini, who is the author of all this. But this is the only invention, I would say, of my book. Everything is historical truth.
In a letter to readers, you say, I'm expecting two kinds of readers. The first has no idea that all these things really happened, knows nothing about 19th century literature, and might even have taken Dan Brown seriously.
Yes, certainly I can expect two kinds of readers. That's why I introduced the illustrations. Mine is an illustrated novel, which is not so strange, because every 19th century novel, especially the popular ones, but even the great classics, were illustrated. And I used illustrations taken from books of that era. But the illustrations have a double function. Some of them are clearly picked up from novels, and so give my reader the impression that I am telling a fantastic story on the 19th century. But suddenly, some illustrations are historical documents. Certain pages of anti-Semitic journals, some portraits of real people, and so on and so forth, so that my reader should feel a sort of shock. I believe it was a fictional story. Now I realize it really happened. And so my reader is oscillating between those two poles.
And to help things along, you have included a main character who it seems that you deliberately made the most cynical and disagreeable in all the history of literature.
I hope you hate him.
Yes.
Yes. Initially, there was, let me say, a sort of moral reason. This character is touching with his hands such trashy material, disgusting material that I wanted the reader was able to keep a distance from him. And so I was obliged to make him repugnant. Step by step, as a narrator, I was taken by the pleasure of constructing such a disgusting character to such an extent that when my wife read the book, only at the end when it was finished, because when writing a book, I go on for 6 or 8 years without informing anybody what I'm doing. When my wife read the book, said, "Oh, now I understand why in the last 2 years you were so bad."
So you do internalize.
So I was becoming, step by step, I was becoming like my character, it seems. Or my wife has a lot of humor.
Simone Simonini is the main character, an Italian Catholic, and writing in the final page of his autobiography says, "Hatred alone warms the heart." And that pretty much tells you everything you need to know about the character.
He makes this appraisal of hatred, yes. But I reflected upon that even after my book, discussing with certain friends. You know, love is a very selective relationship. I love this woman or this man, and I want she loves me and nobody else. I don't want that other people loves her. So it's a sort of isolating relationship. Hatred, on the contrary, is social. An entire people can hate another people. And that's why hatred is used by dictators and in case of war, because it keeps people together more than love. That's explained why people were so eager to make wars, massacres, and so on, because hatred is, unfortunately, a very warm feeling that keep people together.
You make the point that all of the characters except for Simone were real people.
Yes. You know, there was an older Captain Simonini, who was an historical figure, who wrote a famous letter in which he wanted to demonstrate that at the origin of all the conspiracy, there were the Jews. Okay. Nobody knows exactly who was that Captain Simonini. Only the letter is known and circulated a lot during the 19th century. So maybe he, too, is the effect of a forgery. But in any case, the history records the presence of that mysterious Captain Simonini. So my Simonini is the grandchild of this Captain Simonini and receives from him all the racist beliefs. The book starts with a list of declarations against different people. It is not only anti-Jews, anti-Germans, anti-Italians, anti-French, anti-women, anti-everybody. In this sense, my Simonini is a fictional invention, while all the other characters are true. Even characters that some of my readers believed I invented them because they believed it was impossible that they really existed. There is a certain Leo Taxil, who is an incredible character, but he really existed and did what he does in my novel. But I think that in another way, Simonini is truer than the other character. I have the conviction that there are many Simoninis around us. I could point my finger and tell you, this is a Simonini of our time.
The name of the book is The Prague Cemetery. Umberto Eco joins us on The Book Show this week. The novel opens and Simonini is elderly, and there are things that he can't remember about his days, and he has this fear that he's losing his mind. So he starts writing about the past in this effort to hold on to his sanity. And it's really at that beginning where we could have some empathy for a character, but that quickly washes away when we realize the life that he has led.
Yes, certainly. He has a split personality. Why? You know, I have the habit to insert in my novels what I call constrictions. I decide that something must happen, which has nothing to do with the rest of the novel, but obliges me at a certain point to follow a certain track. In this case, the constriction was that Simonini had to visit the milieu of the great physician Charcot. Why I like to do that? There is no reason why. No, for instance, I decided that my novel Baudolino had to start with the siege of Constantinople. Why? Because I had never seen Constantinople and I wanted to visit it. And so, and that obliged me to change the whole story. That's, you know, a constraint is like the rhyme for a poet. It is a constriction, and you are obliged to deal with certain things that command you to do something. Well, in that case, my Simonini had to visit the milieu of Charcot. And I discovered that at that time, Charcot and around him a lot of other people were studying the split personality, this case of hysteria that until that moment was attributed only to women. The name hysteria as a reference to the female uterus, whom, and on the contrary, at that point, Charcot was discovering that there were also cases of male hysteria. And it was typical of certain cases of hysteria, the double personality. The character lived the part one day or one week as a certain person that after a small crisis, he became another person who didn't remember what happened with the first person and so on and so forth. So that following the case of a certain Felida, a woman who existed, I attributed this double personality to one of my characters who is Diane Holm, who was an historical character. She too, but I invented that she had a double personality. At this point, I was caught by the idea that Simonini, being a forgerer that says always the contrary of what is the case, he too should have a double personality. And so I invented this strange case of Simonini that at a certain point doesn't remember what has done in a certain moment, and it is not sure that there is another mysterious character who is the Abbot della Piccola. In the milieu of Charcot, there was at that time the young Sigmund Freud, who was not interested as yet in psychoanalysis, not interested in sex, and he only believed at that time the cocaine could solve all the human problems, diabetes, ocular problems, child sicknesses, everything. No, he wrote even a book on the marvels of cocaine. So it looked for me very interesting to put Simonini in touch with this young physician who was thinking only of cocaine, but step by step he started to imagine that some problems were could be solved through what in English at that time was called a talking cure. And that suggests to Simonini the idea to write down a sort of journal and to cure himself through this journal. That is my novel, which is coming from a suggestion of Dr. Freud.
That meeting with Freud is fascinating, that connection, because Simonini begins with distrust of Freud, because Freud is Jewish, of course.
He's Jewish,
yeah. They become friends, and Simonini procures the cocaine to feed the addiction of the famed psychiatrist. And it is ultimately Freud who helps Simonini in this keeping of a journal, of committing his life to paper.
That was half invention. Dr. Freud said exactly what he said in his letters to the fiancée and so on and so forth. Then I added some little malicious hints, the case that Freud says at that moment, I think I will be never interested in sex because it's another problem, and so on and so forth.
The meticulous detail of your novels, is that the work for you or is that the fun? I mean, realizing that but there's great skill in the writing of it.
Yeah.
But you were talking about just going to Constantinople to see it. So that research, that detail is very important for you.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And as you said, for two reasons. One is, especially in a historical novel, you have to respect all the details. In one of my novels, I say that a person makes three steps. I have to design those steps or to visit a place in which there are three steps in order to know exactly how you move your feet in order to step down, even though the steps are practically not mentioned in the novel. I was told that the great movie director, Luchino Visconti, if two characters had to discuss about some jewels that were in a drawer, and the drawer was never opened, he wanted the jewels in were real jewels. Otherwise, he said, the actors were unable to play in a credible way. And so I need to have real jewels in my drawer. That's it. Second is the great pleasure. Usually a novel takes me 6 years. The Foucault's Pendulum took me 8 years. These years of research of all the details are very beautiful. When the novel is finished, I feel very, very sad and I hate it.
I saw you speak once, and I heard you say that the real challenge for you is to make the writing process last as long as possible, delaying that moment of the end.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a way of delaying continually the end until the moment, and this is another mystery of writing or of fiction, the book says, I am finished. And you have to obey it. The book says stop. Don't add anything else. And you have to stop. Otherwise, one could continue. And in fact, I believe that book would have been finished in 213 or 14. And that at a certain point, I realized that I had to stop. So the research is fascinating. It's not by chance that in describing the 19th century Paris, even though I know Paris very well, but I recovered a lot of old guides and books about the restaurants, about the pubs, about the old streets where they were selling this or that. So I tried really to live in that milieu. Another anecdote regarding my wife. Last year, we went to Paris, and I wanted to visit the streets where Simonini lived. And at a certain point, my wife saw three steps and the door, and he said, did Simonini pass through there? I said, but he didn't exist, so he couldn't pass through there. But my details were so precise that at a certain moment, for a reader, it was difficult to distinguish between reality and fiction.
I would assume that is something that you want of your reader to have that sweat on the brow and the concern of the things that go bump.
No, certainly.
And that's what you're doing. I mean, you want us to believe that he is among us.
Oh, yes. I would like my readers would understand that I was not only telling a past story, but I was alluding to contemporary history. It's enough to see what happened with the WikiLeaks to understand that there are many Simoninis around.
When you look at the at your work, and the book is out, and it's really a 2-year process for you, isn't it? Of once it's done and it's published, of you sort of seeing it through around the world before you move on to the next thing.
Yes, yes. I have always said that to write a novel, more than a linguistic business, is a cosmological affair. You have to build up a world, a complete world, even though you don't speak entirely of it, but you have to set up this world. And language will follow. While in poetry it's exactly the opposite, you must have a language and the possible world will follow. But with a story, you have to feel confident with the world that you build up step by step. That's why, for instance, before writing The Name of the Rose, I spent at least 2 years studying all the possible plans of a library, of an abbey, or designing labyrinths, and so on and so forth. And this is the most enjoying aspect for me, the most enjoying aspect of writing a story. I can guess that for other writers, things may go differently, in the same way in which there are writers that write a novel every year. For me, it would be unthinkable to go so fast. I would lose the 80% of the pleasure of writing.
You spoke a moment ago of Name of the Rose, and is that something that you're greatly proud of the success of that novel?
In a way, I should say that I am irritated by, for these simple reasons, that I give you a scientific example. Every time I publish a new novel, the selling of The Name of the Rose grows up. So readers say, oh, there is a new novel of Eco, but I have not read the first one. So they go to buy the old one and not the new one. So I am in a certain sense blackmailed by the success of the first book. I could say that probably some of the following of my novels are better than The Name of the Rose, but The Name of the Rose is the... But I think it's the same that happened to other writers, let's say Gabriel Garcia Marquez. After 100 years of solitude, he could have written a lot of marvelous books, but people goes always back to 100 years of solitude. Okay, you have to accept that. Obviously, I am very pleased that that book, after 30 years, still have devotees and young readers and survives. Okay, an author cannot be but happy of that.
The name of the new novel is The Prague Cemetery. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Umberto Eco, a great pleasure to have you on the program and an honor. It is. I wish you all the luck in the world with the novel.
For me too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Again, Umberto Eco's new novel is The Prague Cemetery. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Katie Britton produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
understand.